Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. We're not driven by disruption here at Behind the News, at least in the formal sense. Two guests today in two segments. We'll hear from Sohrab Omari on Iran, Israel, and the U.S., and then from Lee Claire LaBerge about her brief career as a businessman and what it taught her about capitalism. It's been hard to keep straight what's been going on with Iran over the last several weeks. First, the Trump administration distanced itself from Israel's attack on the country, and then seeing its military successes, Trump turned cheerleader. Then participant, and then having dropped a bunch of giant bombs, he seemed to lose interest in the fighting and attacked both Iran and especially Israel in terms we can't quote in the air lest the FCC fine us. Iran retaliated, but barely. What's it all mean? And what's been going on inside Iran? To explore these questions, we're joined by Sohrab Omari. Sohrab is a bit out of our normal ideological orbit, but the occasional voyage into the unfamiliar is a good way to expand one's understanding of the world. He's also from Iran, though he came here at a fairly young age. This gives him a lot of contacts in the country. Sohrab is the U.S. editor of Unheard and author most recently of Tyranny, Inc., an exploration of capitalist attacks on freedom and dignity. Sohrab Omari. Trump's approach to the Middle East is looking as volatile as his tariff policy. Unpredictability might be a nice thing in showbiz, but it seems less than ideal in economic policy or diplomacy. He's been all over the place in Iran over the last few weeks. One day, he's distancing himself from Israel. The next day, he's celebrating. The next day, he's cursing him out. He's long been against regime change, but then he embraced it for about 12 hours. What do you make of all this? Is it indecision, confusion, 12-dimensional chess? What do you think?
You know, I think it's a combination of his instincts that are Jacksonian, meaning they're not, as people say, neatly isolationist or restraint oriented, although he's definitely not a regime change neocon either, notwithstanding his brief flirtation with it over the course of this Iran-Israeli conflict. It's more like I punch and I get out, and by punching, I draw a line under an issue and then we can make a deal. And then you have the influence on him of hawks, both inside the administration. There are some, like General Mike Carella, who's the commander of CENTCOM, and John Ratcliffe, reportedly the CIA director. And then outside figures like Miriam Adelson and Mark Levin, the Fox News host. I think the Fox effect is really underestimated. You remember, Doug, at the very beginning when the Israelis invaded, the Trump administration released a statement through Secretary of State Marco Rubio, basically distancing itself from the attack, just saying, not us, none of our business in a way. And that's because I don't think, contrary to the story that emerged later, like Bibi and Trump had planned all along to pull this devious thing where they pretend to negotiate when they really meant to attack. It was that Bibi somewhat surprised Trump, where Trump had given him maybe a yellow light and Bibi took that for a solid green and went forward. And he was prepared to like disavow it if it curdled, if it went south. But early on, the Israelis, as usual, like scored these spectacular intelligence operations and intelligence wins, Mossad, typical bravura performance in spycraft. And he saw that on Fox News and he wanted a part of it. So then the following day, you remember the tone shifted and Trump pretended like he was in on it all along and owned the operation. And the more he did that, the more he was rewarded in the Fox News bubble to which he was confined in a way. And I've heard people say, you know, maybe if he had been on Twitter, if he hadn't been banished from Twitter, he would have seen the kind of opposition that was unfolding from the MAGA sphere. But he didn't. All he got was Mark Levin yelling at him, telling him to do more.
I wonder when he had that, we can't say this word because of the FCC, but, you know, he had that outburst as he was departing for the NATO summit. I was wondering if he was mad that he felt that Bibi had played him in some sense.
First of all, that's the first time, as I know, of a U.S. president berating the Jewish state so publicly and ferociously. I mean, there are moments you can read in the memoirs of various presidents, Democratic and Republican, even if they have good relations normally with Israeli leaders. Every once in a while, there comes a point where the presidents are like running around the Oval Office cussing and want to pull out their hair because the Israelis, on the one hand, are like a kind of client or protectorate of the United States. On the other, when it suits their purposes, according to their own logics, they completely defy what Washington wants. But it's always like in memoirs and things like that. And this was like on TV in front of reporters berating Israel. I think it's a combination. It's just this sense that that Israel tries to drag the United States along. And he went with it somewhat. He delivered something for them. But then at one point, he just wanted to draw a line under it and end it and didn't want to see, as he saw it, Israel misbehaving. And the fact that they were prepared to launch a big air attack enraged him, and he just let loose.
Yeah, he seems to think you can have just like one bold strike and then it's all over. That doesn't seem to be the way war works generally, and it's certainly not consistent with the history of the Middle East over the last century. So I don't know. I don't know what he's thinking.
I wrote this essay for Unheard. The headline is, "Did Iran Win the 12-Day War?" And it's deliberately, I mean, the headline is deliberately provocative. My conclusion in the piece is not that Iran won like rah-rah. Rather, I argue that Iran didn't lose, and that's good enough for them. And it's because of the nature of the attack that President Trump undertook. From Iran's perspective, this war had three key metrics or dimensions. One, most important always for the Islamic Republic, is just simple regime preservation. And they can now turn to their people and say, we withstood an attack from two nuclear powers, one of them the regional hegemon Israel, the other the global superpower of the United States. And it's kind of like the Iran-Iraq war, where the entire West used Iraq as a proxy against us. And in the end, we endured. And now they have that same sense. Yes, there was damage done. Yes, there were scientists and military leaders and command and control structures destroyed. However, the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, walked away with his life. Iran's social fabric held. Iran's territorial integrity was maintained. So that's number one, I mean, from their point of view. Number two is this question of nuclear continuity. Now, initially, President Trump said, we obliterated utterly the Fordo facility with bunker busters. Now other assessments are coming along. One is, you know, this Defense Intelligence Agency report that was leaked to CNN, the New York Times, which said maybe at best they set it back by a few months. However, later on, people pointed out that that was a worst case scenario analysis. But at the end of the day, we do know that very likely, as the Iranians themselves announced on state television, which I was watching the whole time, they removed most of the fissile material. So what's happened is now, you know, you have enriched uranium and know-how still in the country, and we have less of an ability to enforce and inspect than we would have if Bibi had not short-circuited the diplomatic process and not prevented a deal from being formed. And then lastly, like I would say, domestic consolidation, the fact that there was no anti-regime uprising, notwithstanding the fact that the Shah of the late Sun, Reza Pahlavi, was like mobilized as almost a de facto spokesman for the Israeli invasion, calling on Iranians to rise up. That really did not happen. You know, lots of athletes and celebrities inside the country came out for national unity and resolve and said they would rather burn than side with a foreign invader and so on. So on those metrics, again, Iran didn't win. It took a really bad beating, but it didn't lose either. And that, again, as like I said, that might be enough. And this important thing is that that's the problem with the limited strike, because you, as I and Matt Duss, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Sanders, argued in a joint op-ed for the Washington Post before the war, if you're going to hit Fordo, there needs to be a cleanup operation, and that's a ground operation to secure the fissile material. Trump wasn't going to do that, so wouldn't we all have been better with a deal?
Okay, you're from Iran. You've got friends and family there, so you've got better sources than most of us do. Obviously, the regime's power has been significantly reduced, even if obliterated is too strong a word, but what will this do to the regime's durability? Do you see it falling anytime soon?
Not anytime soon. As I said, there was just a rally around the flag, pretty much as critics of hawkish strategies had long warned would happen. Lots of Iranians are unhappy with the regime, but like many people, you know, if you're attacked from the outside, if you're one family and you have all sorts of family internal disputes, but then you get into another dispute with a neighbor, you're going to come together, coalesce together, and repel the external threat. And same thing happens on a national scale. Really did not see anything like that. I mean, you know, Reza Pahlavi was ready to like get enthroned on the Peacock throne. And
he's just not a serious candidate for this, is he?
No, he's not. No, he's not. And I'm kind of just being mean, but he's going to go back to his throne in suburban Washington, basically.
Where his wife is carrying on with the yoga teacher.
That's what they say. he's gonna have to learn to govern the household first before governing an empire. But anyway, the larger point here is that I just didn't see that kind of vision that had long been entertained by neoconservatives and hawks, where there would be a velvet revolution under the aegis of Western warplanes or anything like that. There might be a transition down the road, because after a while, that sense of national unity and resolve will dissipate and people will be mad, especially about the security failures, the fact that, you know, the regime was so vulnerable to Mossad infiltration. But what could come to power, to my mind, more plausibly than like pro-Western Democrats, are security apparatchiks inside the regime who are younger and more ferociously nationalistic and frustrated with the aging Ayatollah and his coterie for not being confrontational enough. They may not have that Islamist component. They may be more nationalistic, but they're going to be fierce. And maybe that's good enough for a lot of Iranian people who just, the main thing, the main irritation is all the kind of Islamic restrictions on daily life. Those are already somewhat relaxed in recent years, especially like women's dress and so on. In certain parts of Tehran, like hijab is just not enforced. That kind of more kind of Western lifestyle can perfectly coexist with a ferociously nationalistic and confrontational regime.
Now, it seems that the Israelis and, you know, certainly some of our neocons really do want a regime change, or even worse or more extreme, total state collapse. What would happen if the current regime went away?
I mean, it depends on how it goes away. I will say early in the conflict, you know, the first 48 hours, I was really worried about a precipitous state collapse, because this is a nation of 90 million. And ethnically, it's, people sometimes use Persia to refer to Iran, and that's the ancient Greek word for the country. But Persians only make up a bare majority, you know, 49%, 50% of the country. There's about a quarter that are Azeris, meaning a Turkic people. I myself am half Persian and half Azeri. The supreme leader is Azeri. There's Kurds, Lors, Baluch, etc. And in part as a result of chauvinistic mistreatment of these minorities by central governments, not just the Islamic Republic, you know, there is kind of separatist feelings out there. So that I would be really worried about, like, Iran breaking apart, because that would radiate instability into areas in which the U.S. has serious interests or personnel. It would definitely affect Iraq. It would affect Azerbaijan and Turkey. It would affect Pakistan and Afghanistan around the Baluchi areas. And so that's one fear. Another fear for me was, what would happen to this, like, fissile material? There are Baluchi Sunni Islamists in Iran who, you know, is a nightmare scenario if they got a hold of nuclear material. How would we secure that in the event of a precipitous regime collapse? So these were my fears early on. And I wrote a piece saying the regime change maniacs are back was the headline. However, I have to say, as the days went on, it became clear that the Iranian regime is proving more resilient. And that's not my main fear anymore. It's not like a sudden regime collapse. But that would be disastrous. And the fact that some of the hawks casually talk about it shows you how reckless they are.
Well, I'm speaking with Sohrab Amari, U.S. editor of Unheard. Yeah, I mean, it seems like Israel and some of our neocons won't be very satisfied until something like that happens. Are they just hanging back for the moment and going to unleash it all in a little while?
Depends. I think the hawks, just like the camps and the restraint faction has internal camps, there are different factions on the hawkish side as well. There are some who are really happy, you know, with what transpired. And I think that, you know, President Trump really did set back the nuclear program and Israel's operation was quite successful and so on. But there are others like Mark Levin. I don't know how people watch the show. It's like elder abuse to me, because his audience is pretty old and he just yells at them. And he calls, like, even conservative opponents of military action, these Marxist Islamists. I'm not joking. That's a quote. You know, he's very angry. And there are others in like the hard right of Israel who think that this was a betrayal by Trump that really only regime change would do. On the more sophisticated side, I saw people associated with Foundation for Defense of Democracies, which is one of the big hawkish think tanks, said, like, look, this issue will not be resolved until there's a different regime in place. At least one of their directors, Mark Dubowitz, said that. So there are some who really will not rest until that comes about. But I don't know. I increasingly actually think in the wake of this conflict that that's going to become less, not more likely.
And I guess people are seeing this as a great victory for Israel, is it?
You know, I think that Iran didn't lose, and that's pretty bad for Israel, even if you can count up the damage that Israel did, and there's no denying it. For a while, Israel basically just had an open access to Iran's skies, stretching from Western Iran all the way to the capital in the center. So that's pretty bad, right? And they blew up all sorts of stuff and figures and, of course, civilians as well. However, there are other aspects that were revealed that I think revealed Israeli weakness. So, for example, the fact that initially lots of the hawks said, well, we don't want America to do anything. Just get out of Israel's way so it can do its thing. And then 24 hours after the invasion began, they formally requested the United States assistance. And then the smallness of Israel, which is 80 times smaller in area and at 1/10 of the population of Iran, really was felt. You know, those missiles, the ballistics, hypersonic systems that Iran kept launching, that in terms of Israel's prestige, the footage of these kind of almost like malevolent shooting stars landing in Tel Aviv, landing in Haifa, will not soon be erased from people's minds in the Middle East. And like they, in many cases, now people have put the footage to like house dance music and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And if the war had gone on without the U.S. basically stepping in to partition the two sides, yes, Israel could have leveled Iran because of its technological superiority, but and Iran would have been reduced to like a medieval state. People would have sustained themselves on potatoes and grass. However, those ballistics would keep coming. Because that's Iran's defense doctrine, is attritional warfare involving missiles. And Israel's pretty small. And after a while, the psychological and material damage inflicted by these missiles night after night, night after night, could have been pretty devastating for Israel, especially as we now know they were almost close to running out of interceptors. And the interceptors, after a while, weren't working anyway. They became confused. In one case, they targeted each other. I mean, in that sense, I think those are some big L's for Israel. And then the other thing is, I think at the level of American policy, although they got what they wanted, which is an attack on the nuclear facilities, you saw the fissures on the American right, where lots of MAGA people were pretty fed up and they didn't want to get involved. And they became more strident. They didn't back down when Trump dropped the hammer. And then at the level of the policy professionals who staff security agencies, especially in the Pentagon, I know for a fact, lots of the younger people there just aren't attached to Israel the way the older people are. Like, it's not like they hate Israel per se, but they just want to think of it as another country that has its own interests. Sometimes they align with America's and sometimes they don't. Like this kind of messianic commitment to Israel and the sense that it's almost an extension of the United States is pretty alien and weird to them. And I think those people are now determined to make sure there's not a repeat of this 12-day war, where Israel gets to surprise the United States and then dictate action to them.
Israel had been losing a lot of support in the West, popular more than official, over the war in Gaza. Has that slippage been contained or reversed by recent events, or do you think Israel still has some serious political problems in the West?
I don't think so. I don't think that's gone away as an issue. I mean, look, I consider myself someone who supports Israel's right to exist as a, you know, safe and sovereign homeland for the Jewish people in their ancestral home. But, and I've always said that, and after October 7th happened, I said, you know, Israel has a right to defend itself. But that's not an unlimited right to turn this enclave into an abattoir. At some point, this footage piles up and, you know, people on the right, as I'm of the center right, and people on the left, where you see, you know, one footage after another of babies with missing limbs and starving babies because their mothers don't have breast milk and all that stuff. Like, it's like, okay, you know, there's got to be some settlement. One good thing that came out of this was President Trump today we're recording this on Wednesday, at the NATO summit said that there's going to be a ceasefire deal. I don't know why that, because he hadn't talked about Gaza for a long time. Could be because he feels like he did something for the Israelis and now he can extract something out of them. But whatever that is, I think that's pretty positive. But I don't think the larger political problem will go away, especially as it becomes clear and clear that Israel's political class is not interested in the two-state solution, like the ideal of two people side by side. At least for me, my support was always premised on the idea that at least rhetorically they would pay lip service to that. And they don't even bother anymore. I mean, so you're going to rule over 5 million people who are like second-class citizens and have no possibility of self-determination? I don't think that flies in the 21st century, but we'll see.
Mamdani's victory in the Democratic primary in New York City, among other things, shows that the anti-Semitism labels looks to have lost. Do you see things that way?
I personally disagree with the slogan "globalize the Intifada," and especially in a place like New York City, which is has the largest population of Jews outside Israel. However, at the same time, I mean, some of the reaction you see to him is so extreme, where it's like this is America's Kristallnacht, and you're like, well, he campaigned with Brad Lander. I'm pretty friendly with Brad, and he's not this like devious Nazi or something like that. He's just critical of Israel. Maybe he puts that more forcefully than I would. But I mean, I think that characterizing him as a Muslim Nazi or whatever, just it's so far from the reality. I'm a New Yorker, like that I experience daily in what the city's politics are like. Yeah. My short answer to your question, sorry, that was rambly, is yes.
You are hard to classify politically, but you do have friends and allies on the right, more than I do, for sure. And you talked about this a little, but what does the landscape look like on the right end of the spectrum now? It looks rather divided. You've got split within MAGA. You got Steve Bannon versus, the Mark Levins of the tendency. How do you think this is going to play out?
I think it's largely generational. Real Clear polling found that the group that shifted most sharply toward having an unfavorable view of Israel is Republicans between the ages of 18 and 49. They went from 35% unfavorable views in 2019 to 50% today. And I think that will hold, because on the one hand, you do have this apparatus of Fox News and Tammy Bruce, the State Department spokesman, who a month ago apparently gave an interview with an Israeli outlet. And she was saying, it's so great to represent the greatest country on earth, and then paused and corrected herself and said, next to Israel.
I was stunned by that. I couldn't believe that.
Idiomatically, actually, that means that the United States is second best. It's a really weird thing to say. That kind of attitude is falling out of fashion on the right, and that will have policy effects. Like I said, there are younger people in the policy pipeline of the Pentagon and State Department who just don't have that total commitment to Israel, even if they're not hostile. And then, more broadly in the magosphere. Now, however, in the magosphere or Zoomer media, that skepticism often does actually bleed into really scary anti-Semitism. Like, there is legitimate Nazi type stuff on the right, where it blurs hostility to Israel's influence on American foreign policy. It blurs that with legitimately blood-chilling rhetoric and imagery. Of course, it's always with a wink and treated as it's okay. Well, this is provocation, and you don't want it's ironic. It's not serious, but I find it revolting. But I do think, look, if we should be able to, on the one hand, confront overt anti-Semitism like that, like Nick Fuentes is this like young kid who's very popular among Zoomers and is like a legitimate Jew hater. To be able to confront that and at the same time to like question Israeli policy when it goes against U.S. national interests or when it's just inhumane, I don't see why we can't do both.
That was Sohrab Amari, U.S. editor of Unheard. His article that asked whether Iran won the 12-day war is on the Unheard website, unherd.com. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the second movement of Giacinto Scelsi's String Quartet No. 1, performed by the Arditi Quartet. Next, Inside the Hidden Abode of Capital. There's a famous passage in Volume 1 of Marx's Capital, or Das Kapital, for those of you who say Buch 1, where he writes, "Accompanied by Mr. Moneybags and by the possessor of labor power, we therefore take leave for a time of this noisy sphere, where everything takes place on the surface and in view of all men, and follow them both into the hidden abode of production, on whose threshold there stares us in the face no admittance except on business." In her new book, just out from Haymarket, Fake Work, How I Began to Suspect Capitalism as a Joke, Leclerc LaBerge takes us inside a modern factory, the late consulting and accounting firm Arthur Anderson, where she briefly worked as a freshly minted college grad. Anderson was the auditor for a number of high-profile corporate frauds of the 1990s, notably WorldCom and Enron. Enron's accounts were totally fictional, but Anderson signed off on them, and when it all blew up in 2001, Anderson's complicity was revealed. It was convicted of obstruction of justice in June 2002 and was dissolved soon afterwards. That was less than 2 years after Lee Clare's work there was done. She is a professor of English at Borough of Manhattan Community College. Her previous book, which she was on the show to discuss in November 2023, is The Marvelous Marx for Cats, Leclerc LaBerge. What you write about takes me back. Those, in some ways, were glorious times that I occasionally find myself nostalgic for. Money seemed free. It was a time of capitalist utopianism. I wrote a book about it. You lived through it. But a lot of the audience might not know. So take us back to that exuberant moment of the late 90s.
I describe the late 90s in the book, in Fake Work, as the first sort of great speculative financial bubble of our present era. So in my mind, I'm thinking of sort of the late 90s to now as a contiguous time space. So in the late 1990s, or actually probably more starting in the mid-1990s by 1996.
Yeah, the Netscape IPO was 95. So
95, okay. So mid-1990s, you had the Netscape IPO. I mean, you had the beginnings of, in what one of my books, Scandals and Abstraction, I call financialization. But the idea that people like you and me would just be talking about an IPO, a public offering for a stock company. But you had the beginnings of the dot-com bubble, where all of this Clintonite easy money is flowing around and is flowing into these new technologies, most of which, in terms of companies, really not much came of them. It's sort of funny. In the book, I talk about the days before we had iPhones and I this and I that, we had E. E was the great vowel. So this was the beginnings of e-commerce, when everything could seemingly be put online. And there was e-travel agencies, e-rent-a-car, e-mattress sellers, e-this, e-that. And the money flowing through New York City, which started to get called Silicon Alley, and then, of course, Silicon Valley, was huge and was so exciting, certainly for me. You had the start of E-Trade, right? These ads that would appear on television, like everyone can be their own stockbroker. You know, there's nothing holding you back from participating in this incredible financializing economy that will remake the world and everything in it. Now, we can debate whether or not that happened, but that was the moment. That was the zeitgeist. And it very much influenced me and won me over.
Compared to the last 15, 20 years, it was an exuberant moment. And there was some kind of democratic utopianism to it, which doesn't exist in our capitalist culture today, which just seems dark. And the social Darwinist aspect of it seems much more prominent, more foregrounded. So it really was effectively just a very different period.
I think so, yeah.
And you, of course, participated in it. The fly in the ointment at the time, of course, was Y2K was going to arrive and produced all kinds of unknown adventures. And then you found yourself working for a consulting firm. So tell us about your career. What exactly did you do and for whom?
Well, after your first question, where I was just gave you the answer, where I'm talking about how all of these incredible internet companies were starting and everybody wanted to get hired at them. And, you know, anybody who had a pulse, a trained monkey, anybody could get a job in the dot-com bubble. I actually couldn't get a job. I tried to get a job in one of those companies and I failed. So I moved to New York City in 1998, having graduated with a degree in philosophy from Hampshire College. And after a few months of trying this and trying that, one day I just happened into a headhunter with the surreal title of Careers by Penthouse. It's right near the Port Authority bus station.
Was that real or is that a fake name?
No, that's the real name.
Wow, that sounds like
Yeah.
A bit sleazy in its...
It was one of these places where the headhunters could still smoke. But what did I care? It's like at a certain point I needed a job. And I had decided when I graduated, like what I really want to do is be a businessman. Now, this was an indistinct category for me. I thought like, okay, I'll go work in the dot-coms.
Parenthetically, I notice you keep saying businessman, refer to yourself as a businessman.
Yes.
And not some genderless title. So why the use of that word?
You know, it's funny. I think for me, I do refer to myself as that throughout the book. And I do think that was the sort of desire. You know, if you think back to like careerist or yuppie-ish women, like late 80s, early 1990s, the sort of Sigourney Weaver model you might think of, I found them very off-putting. I mean, I am queer, so it's kind of a term of queer desire. It's not necessarily like a trans term, but definitely like my psychoanalytic identification, if you will, was with businessmen. And I thought like, that's who I want to be in conversation with. That's who I want to work with. That's who I want to be around. And then, you know, when I learned what management consulting was, I mean, it's much harder to get hired at a management consultancy than it is, I think, at a dot-com fly-by-night shop. But they sort of style themselves. Like in the book, I use some quotes from Gramsci's The Prison Notebooks about what is an organic intellectual. But I think management consultants, certainly in the 90s and the early aughts, they were sort of the philosophers of the corporate world. They would go into situations, not really to get involved with them, like different companies here and there, but to study them and to sort of pronounce judgment on them. This is what should be done. I mean, they don't necessarily do it themselves, but they say, this is what should happen. This is how this company should write its course. It usually involves firing people. You know, there are not that many ways to make money. And if you're paying the management consultancy, you've got to make up for it somewhere else.
That was a period when capitalism was producing a lot of philosophy about itself.
Completely, completely. And of course, I had been a philosopher in college. So here I was, 22. I thought, I am a philosopher. Like, this will be perfect. And then I think it really was serendipity. I mean, it really was dumb luck that I happened onto this headhunter. Once I got hired, a few of us, I talked with my colleagues, like anybody who had stopped by this headhunter Thursday afternoon or whatever it was, got sent to this conglomerate, what I call the conglomerate, this large communications company, and basically got hired. And then of those, I was sort of somehow judged to be the most philosophical for whatever reason, and was put on a team with Arthur Andersen consultants who were there to design and administer a sort of Y2K prophylactic, a global prophylactic, so that if the worst of the predictions did happen, this Fortune 500 communications conglomerate for whom I worked would not be held legally responsible for whatever contracts or advertisements it was or wasn't able to place as the result of a kind of Y2K Armageddon.
Most of it was about litigation insurance, right?
Yeah, forestalling litigation or being able to go into litigation and say, look, we did our duty. We did our best. Here we have it. We have 14 stories of paperwork that archives everything we did to say that we tried to be able to place advertisements. This conglomerate I worked for is primarily an advertising company. We tried to be able to place advertisements, and we tried to be able to be contractually responsible in the face of Y2K.
I'm guessing everyone knows what Y2K was, that the change in the first two digits of the year would break old computer code and cause planes to fall out of the air and bank networks to crash. So what was your part in the struggle to prevent all these disasters from happening?
Arthur Andersen, the team I worked on, they had devised a kind of company mantra, project mantra for this conglomerate that I think does a really nice job of summarizing what we were doing. And the mantra was, Y2K is a documentation problem, not a technology problem. So we're not going to worry about the technology. Like, whatever happens, happens. Maybe computers go offline. Maybe they don't. Who are we to try to fix something like that? We're going to worry about the documentation. So for the first 6 months or so of my employ, alongside my Arthur Anderson colleagues, what we were doing was this conglomerate owned at that time about 1,100 advertising and communications agencies all over the world. And we had asked them for a copy of their technology, their technological inventories, come in on a spreadsheet. And the company analysts would then input the data from the spreadsheet into the database. Now, somebody had to check to make sure that that data had been input correctly. So it was the Arthur Anderson consultants and me, the sort of best and the brightest, who would take the original spreadsheet and then compare it to the information in the database and make sure they matched. And we did that about 8 hours a day for 6 months.
It sounds very dull.
It was stultifying. I mean, it was beyond stultifying. But, I mean, the work itself was stultifying. But for me, what started to become interesting and what really is the genesis of the book is starting to realize, oh my God, like, is this how companies work? Is this a view of global corporate capitalism and its sort of millennial American instantiation? Because if it is, that's interesting. The work itself was really not so interesting. But the milieu was interesting. It took me 4 or 5 months of checking spreadsheets against a database before I started to sort of come out of this Excel torpor and be able to have a thought about what it was actually going on.
And you were keeping a diary at the time, which you called your Bildungsroman, which is the basis for this book. What did you record in the Bildungsroman?
I started to think about the office mantra, right? Y2K is a documentation problem, not a technology problem. And the office itself was, you know, very litigious. I mean, that was the point of the office, right? Like, if there were a lawsuit, we would be the ones to say, look, we tried everything. Here's our proof. Here's the paper trail. And at a certain point, I started to take this as like a personal calling. Like, in addition to checking the documentation of the conglomerate, I should produce my own documentation, a sort of counter archive. And honestly, it's, you know, one of the few things that made the days go faster, because really checking spreadsheets 8 hours a day, weeks and months on end, I mean, it does have an effect on one. So I started to write little character studies of my colleagues, or, you know, if there were a particularly surreal moment, like at a meeting, or sometimes the office would get very excited and we'd be told, you know, a general partner is coming in today. You know, everybody look sharp, or an executive council meeting will be here today or tomorrow. You know, everybody wear a suit. And I would just try to sort of document the temporality. And I worked at this job for about, I guess, 15 or 16 months. And by the end of it, I was sort of spending half of my time doing my own writing, just sort of writing this book, which I called, I think, very, you know, narcissistically, Bildungsroman. It was going to be a nonfiction account of coming of age in a corporate world, in a corporate milieu.
But you were like 22 at the time, right?
I was 22 going on 23. I mean, I wrote it when I was 22 and 23. So it was very bold. You know, I think I probably wrote about maybe a 300-page manuscript. I don't know. But I quote from it in Fake Work. And I think about maybe 400 words of those 300 pages are salvageable. But what it did give me was this incredible archive. I mean, that's how I could go back and write this book now. That's how I could, you know, remember, what does the photocopier look like? What does this colleague wear? How does this colleague talk? So it was a sort of really fun project in the sense of I was working with my own business archive, my own capitalist archive of my time as either a failed or successful businessman, depending on how one views the situation.
I'm speaking with Lee Claire LaBerge, author of Fake Work, just out from Haymarket. Over and over, people refer to the process, and you refer to the process. What was this process with a capital P?
The process was what the conglomerate purchased when it purchased a project from Arthur Anderson. So the process was the sort of totality of knowledge and of practice that the Anderson people both inhabited and shepherded through the office. You know, it was never defined. It wasn't written down, but it was constantly appealed to, right? Like, how many people should check a spreadsheet? Well, the process says at least one person needs to check every spreadsheet, and then there needs to be a random check of that person's check. Or how many days should the meeting last? Well, the process says this. How should the database be constructed? Well, the process says this. But only the Arthur Anderson people could implement the process. So it was proprietary, and it sort of organized everything we did. And, you know, when I first started working there, really as, yes, a 22-year-old philosopher from Hampshire College, I was sort of awed by the process. Like, well, what is the process? Like, will I ever see it? Will I ever find it? Is it tangible? Will I get behind it? But then by the end of my sojourn at the conglomerate, I realized the process is just what Arthur Anderson does on any given day to indemnify itself and its colleagues. But everybody gets behind it, and they do really consider themselves the sort of philosophers of the corporate, or they did. They consider themselves the philosophers of the corporate world. So, you know, the process, it's like a Platonic form. It organizes everything, but it's not necessarily visible in anything.
It sounds like everybody took this very seriously. I mean, did anyone have a sense that this was nonsensical and absurd?
No, absolutely not. I mean, if they did, it was in the deepest reaches of their conscience, and they never said it, and they never betrayed it. And on January 3rd of the year 2000, I think January 1st was a Saturday, so we all came back in the office on Monday, and it's like, nothing happened. Okay, here we are. We've spent millions of dollars.
Devoted a year of your lives to this. And
yeah, I mean, the money, the travel, the process. No one even said nothing happened. It was just like, okay, well, our work here is done. On to the next thing. And they were. And they, you know, they went on to the next thing. I didn't, obviously, because I worked with Arthur Anderson, but I was not part of their team. I mean, I was part of the team, but I was never hired by them. So when it all sort of just one day came and one day went, and then it was the new millennium and we were all fine, everything just dissolved and everybody went their own way.
Okay. So then you went to graduate school and became a Marxist. What did your experience with Anderson, how did that contribute to your being a Marxist?
When I write in the book that I wanted to be a businessman, like I was ready to sell out. I mean, it never occurred to me that to sell out, you have to have someone willing to buy your wares. But, you know, I was ready to do it, right? And then I got there and I thought, I mean, I've already said this in our interview, but it really, like, the absolute nothingness that defined our days and our project and our lives, like all to make sure that advertisements could be placed in the first week of the third millennium. It was sort of a Copernican shift for me, or sort of a Copernican revolution, in the sense that if this is capitalism, how does this organize our social forms, our historical forms, our cultural forms? Like, I want to know more about this. But what working with Arthur Anderson, what that experience gave me was at least the knowledge that they're working with them is not the place to learn about what global capitalism is. It's the place to maybe observe some of its symptoms or some of its minor forms, but it's not the place to understand why here, why now, and for whom. So in a way, I'm very appreciative of the time I spent there and of my colleagues there, because they sort of introduced me to some of the problems of political economy. And I do think it was that experience that led me to ask, I mean, the kind of questions that I've really been asking in my research now for 25 years, right? Like, how is this economy structured? What are its cultural forms? What are the narratives that it tells about itself or that other people can tell about it? What are the sort of liminal spaces where those narratives can be challenged and changed? I do trace so much of that back to my experience working on this surreal Y2K project with the company that was auditing Enron.
In a lot of ways, Arthur Andersen was an outlier. It's like a fraudulent company. Their most famous client was Enron, but they also did Global Crossing too, right?
Yeah.
Two of the
WorldCom.
Biggest. WorldCom?
Wow. They also did WorldCom, yeah.
Oh, God. So all the giant corporate mm-hmm. frauds of the era, all that went poof. Enron, mm-hmm. Global Crossing, WorldCom, mm-hmm. Arthur Andersen got forcibly dissolved, right?
Yes.
There's also a real world of goods and services getting produced. Labor is exploited, profit extracted. Mm-hmm. You know, there were programmers who were fixing the COBOL problems back when, you know, Arthur mm-hmm. Andersen was doing whatever. So how do entities like these, the Arthur Andersens, Enrons of the world, fit into this, you know, structure of a larger capitalism where they actually do make stuff and provide services?
You know, it's such an interesting question. And it's something that actually I think might be changing right now under sort of the Trump-Musk regime. But I'll answer it without the contribution of the Trump-Musk regime first, and then I'll speculate on it for a second. Arthur Andersen was an auditor, right? And that has a very specific function in corporate capitalism. It's like someone's got to be there certifying this stuff, right? How do you know when you buy your Enron stock that it's not all just made up? Well, in that case, it turns out it was all just made up, right? But someone's got to be there to say, we checked the books, these valuations are real, this whole juggernaut, which we also, you know is the stock market, can go forward, because these quarterly reports, these index real values. Now, Arthur Andersen, by the late 1990s and early aughts, was engaged in fraudulent auditing. But they also, as part of that, did consulting work. And that's where teams of Arthur Andersen auditors would advise businesses on, you know, what gets called best practices. These are the people who started the best practices, that term that's now become so ubiquitous. And they would advise companies how to conduct themselves, how to comport themselves, how to be more profitable, how to streamline themselves, how to present information to their auditors so that they could pass an audit. So I think on the consulting side, and I think on the cultural side of what is the place of management consultancies in sort of 1990s or early aughts or even up until, you know, the 20-teens capitalism, it's in many ways a legitimizing discourse of business itself, of what it is, how it should operate, who should come in these revolving doors. I mean, these companies recruit from elite universities, you know, they demand the best and the brightest. But in a certain level, they're parlaying in a kind of, I think, very abstract, very sort of legitimizing forms of knowledge and discourse. Now, the end part of that question the question I then would ask is, does that still obtain, will that role still be necessary under the sort of Trump Musk, like, just close it, just shut it down. Like, we don't need a field of legitimacy in which to operate anymore. I think
we could just openly lie with these
people. Yeah, forget it. You know, like, no holds barred. But certainly, I would say from the mid 80s until, let's say, Trump 2, I think that was part of the roles of a management consultancy. Is it to produce widgets? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It is not productive. You know, it's what gets consigned to the fire economy, the finance, insurance, real estate, more abstract, discursive organizations of this very elite node of cosmopolitan capitalism in certain places.
So do you ever regret not having pursued the life of the businessman?
You know, right before it all ended, meaning my life as a businessman, the conglomerate for which I worked, they, you know, told me I had done a good job, and they said, well, obviously the Y2K office is shutting down. I mean, they never needed it even leading up to Y2K. They certainly wouldn't need it after Y2K. But they said it's shutting down, but, you know, you've done a good job, and we can place you in a public relations firm as an assistant to an account executive. I don't even remember the title, but something which told me in no uncertain terms that the worst of my businessman life, the spreadsheets, the administrative labor, the photocopying, that's what would greet me. So I walked away, and I think I walked away very happy and very energized by the experience. I mean, it really did motivate me to ask the questions I still ruminate about. But at the same time, one of the things that I think people will get who read Fate Work is the amount of money, the amount of resources, the amount of possibility that these Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 companies have compared to like a public university. Like I teach at CUNY. I mean, we're told regularly, okay, there's no more paper for the rest of the semester. Or, you know, if you want to use your dry erase board, you're going to need to buy the markers yourself. Part of me wonders what it would be like to work in a scene that had abundance, that had resources. I mean, no, the flip side of that is the waste and the, you know, just absolute insane spending that I witnessed while at the conglomerate. But it's an experience that I don't wish I had stayed on that track, but I do wish that the allotment of monetary and social values in our contemporary society were drawn up a little bit differently.
Well, that's capitalism, isn't it? It's like either austerity or extravagant waste.
I suppose so. It certainly has been in my case.
That was Lee Claire LaBerge, author of Fake Work, How I Began to Suspect Capitalism as a Joke, just out from Haymarket Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of an artifact of the new economy era, Pressure Suit by Adult. Till next week, bye. Put on my pressure suit. Put on my pressure suit. Put on my pressure suit. Put on my pressure suit.